We should not mind so small a flower, except it quiet bring our little garden that we lost back to the lawn again. So spicy her carnations nod, so drunken reel her bees, so silver steal 100 flutes from out 100 trees, that whoso sees this little flower by faith may clear behold the bobolinks around the throne and dandelions gold.
A poem by Emily Dickinson, read by actress Colleen Madden. According to Judith Farr, author of the book The Gardens of Emily Dickinson, flower gardens were essential to Emily Dickinson. They were food for both the spirit and the muse. Dickinson grew just about every flower you can think of.
She had a cutting garden. In other words, she had flowers for cutting, and that was in the larger garden. There were 2 acres of garden. So there were sweet peas, there were Gallica roses, roses of all kinds. There were oleander. Well, actually, the oleander was out in the primary garden in the summer, but otherwise in the conservatory. There were many, many lilies. There was heliotrope, gentians, anemone, daisies, just so many. Star of Bethlehem, sweet alyssum, sweet pea, rhododendrons. It's hard to know where to stop. Marigold, mignonette. She had a real Victorian garden. And then in the conservatory, she did what were to me the most extraordinary things, growing Cape jasmine, which we now call gardenia, and growing the only thing she didn't grow that was really an exotic flower that she could have grown was the orchid. And I think the reason she did not grow orchids is that they lack scent. She loved flowers to be fragrant.
I want to get a sense of how Emily Dickinson felt about flowers and gardens. I gather they were very important to her. Do you know why?
Well, I don't think it's too hard to know why, really. She, at one point, I started with her so long ago, really almost as a child, and I remember coming across one of her letters in which she said, "I was reared in the garden." And I thought that was quite taking. And then I discovered that, you know, her mother, Mrs. Emily Dickinson, had been passionate about flowers, especially roses. And they had had an extraordinarily vast garden, first in Mount Pleasant Street, which I guess earlier had been West Street, and then finally at what is now the Emily Dickinson Museum and used to be called the Homestead. She just loved flowers from childhood and used to wander through the woods picking wildflowers and so on. And then it became an intellectual pursuit almost. She named them and entered them into her herbarium, which can still be seen at Harvard.
So a lot of this information about her relationship with flowers comes from her letters and diaries and not
yes.
just from the poetry?
She never actually kept a diary precisely, but she wrote many letters. And the letters are a tremendously important source for understanding why the gardens meant so much to her. And let us not forget her conservatory. Her father had a conservatory built for her in 1855, and it was just so that she could grow exotic flowers like camellias and gardenias.
Can you give me some sense, can you paint a picture for me of what her life was like when she was gardening?
Well, I would love to try. For one thing, she gardened, as I say, from the time she was 12 or 13, but then it became an extraordinary passion around the 1860s. And she seems to have gotten up early in the morning to do her primary or attend her primary vocation, which was writing poetry. She wrote poetry before the others got up. And then in the afternoon, she seems to have turned to flowers. But increasingly, it became the late afternoon because, as many of your listeners will know, she was somewhat reclusive. The garden was completely enclosed so that she wasn't easily seen from the outside or seen, you know, by passersby. But nevertheless, she preferred the late afternoon, and she would spend several hours. And children would often be allowed to come in and watch her planting or transplanting flowers.
She went back and forth between the business of being in the garden and writing about the garden. Do we get pictures from her poetry of what her garden looked like?
Yes, there's a actually, there's a marvelous poem, which is a love poem, a poem of reproach to a man with whom I think she was deeply in love in the mid-1860s. He was the editor of the Springfield Republican. His name was Samuel Bowles, and he seems to have returned her affection to some extent, more than to some extent. The family destroyed all his letters to her, of which he had copies. And in this poem, "I tend my flowers for thee, bright absentee," she describes the contents of the garden.
Does it bring it to life for you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I wonder if I could find it. I think I could probably find it. It's, "I tend my flowers for thee, bright absentee. My fuchsia's coral seams rip while the sower dreams. Geraniums tint and spot. Low daisies dot. My cactus splits her beard to show her throat. Carnations tip their spice and bees pick up. A hyacinth I hid puts out a ruffled head. And odors fall from flasks so small you marvel how they held. Globe roses break their satin flake upon my garden floor. Yet thou not there. I had as lief they bore no crimson more. Thy flower be gay, her lord away, it ill becometh me. I'll dwell in calyx gray, how modestly, alway, thy daisy draped for thee." And he used to call her his daisy. So what you have here are all the flowers not really blooming well, in fact looking pretty bad because he's gone, and she herself is not blooming either.
Did she, do you think, have a favorite flower?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. She did, I think, but at one, you know, she changes her mind. At one point she said it was the Indian pipe, and so just before she died, Mabel Loomis Todd, who was her first editor, painted Indian pipes for her. And they are, for those who don't know, I would never have known because I grew up in Manhattan. They're really fungoids, and they're white, rather charming but timid flowers that grow up next to tree roots. And as I say in the acknowledgments in the book, my editor, who was a splendid editor at Harvard Press, found Indian pipes next to her door as she was working on this book. We thought it was very amusing.
Could you give me an example of a poem that brings any one of those flowers to life?
Sure. I do think one thing is very interesting, and that is that she does not write with a great deal of interest in the rose. It's something that she talks about frequently, but she doesn't write with much real pleasure about. I think she felt that so many people had written poems about roses it had become kind of trite. Mm. She does write a small poem about a rose, which she included in a letter to her cousin Eudocia Flint. And this is interesting because it's typical of Dickinson's punning characteristic, her habit of punning. She says to Eudocia, "All the letters I can write are not as fair as this," in other words, the rose. "Syllables of velvet, sentences of plush, depths of ruby, undrained, hid lip for thee." Now, curiously, here she fuses the idea of the rose and the idea of a poem, so language and flowers become one, and the rose is a letter. She's sending it to Eudocia, and it's got syllables of velvet, and it's full of sentences of plush, and you have to, I guess, imagine the architecture of the rose, the sort of wonderful fluting qualities of the rose, and then depths of ruby, the very center of that rose would be full of fragrance, and she's inviting Eudocia Flint to smell it. But what I find wonderful about this poem is, of course, that some roses in her time were called deep cup, actually in our own as well, deep cup roses, and this is obviously a deep cup rose. So she's very, very specific.
As a gardener, I suppose that spring must have been a very important time for Emily Dickinson. Is that true?
Yes, it was. She actually, different from what some critics say, she did not despise winter because she said winter under cultivation was as arable as spring. But spring was her favorite season. Not summer, because she felt summer gave you such a very great deal and then disappeared, almost like a kind of cheat. She was gone after giving you these extraordinarily subtle and voluptuous experiences. But spring, she says, spring is the period express from God. Among the other seasons, himself abide, but during March and April, none stir abroad without a cordial interview with God. And I think one of the things that moves me about Emily Dickinson is that she was not a confident believer. She tried desperately to be a conventional Christian, but was not. But she had a profound desire for the idea of God and for heavenly life.
It sounds as though when she was in her garden, she felt closest to her idea of God.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. And there's the famous cute poem, you know, that everybody loves about some keep the Sabbath going to church and others don't. Others stay at home. And it gives you a picture of her in her garden. She's in the garden worshiping under the arches of the trees while other people are singing hymns. And she feels that's really the more correct way.
Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home, with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a dome. Some keep the Sabbath in surplice. I just wear my wings, and instead of tolling the bell for church, our little sexton sings. God preaches, a note of clergyman, and the sermon is never long. So instead of getting to heaven at last, I'm going all along.
Colleen Madden reading Emily Dickinson's poetry. Judith Farr is the author of the book The Gardens of Emily Dickinson.